Hello, Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. I'm Jasmine Smith, and Robert Connie is still on paternity leave. So with me today, I have two attorneys. We're continuing our law series. I have E.A. Duncan and Darren Neal, who both practice family law. We're also going to talk about the Breonna Taylor investigation and our COVID-19 update. So without further ado, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast, EA and Darren.
Thanks, Jasmine.
Hi. We are here today to talk to Darren because he is a judicial candidate for Family Court Division 3 in Jefferson County. Darren grew up in Bowling Green before graduating from Georgetown College and University of Kentucky College of Law. And then after law school, he settled in Louisville, and he's practiced family law ever since. He's worked as a judicial staff attorney, a divorce and custody attorney, and now he's an assistant county attorney who practices in family court. So we're going to talk to him today about family courts in general and his run for judge. So first, Darren, over the last couple weeks, we've talked criminal law, we've talked appellate courts and bankruptcy courts. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what practicing in family court looks like before we get to your judicial race. And, you know, I think most people probably think about divorce and custody cases, but that's not all that family court is. So can you talk a little bit about different types of cases that family court judges hear and issues that they deal with?
Oh, yeah, of course. So naturally, I think that you are correct that most people believe that when you hear family court, you think divorce, you think child custody cases. But family court is actually, it's what's known as a hybrid. When it was first created, I think it was added to our Constitution in 2002. It was a hybrid of both district court and circuit court. So it takes the family-related issues from both of those. From district court, it took paternity docket, it took the dependency, neglect, and abuse docket, and the domestic violence docket. And then from the circuit court, it took divorce, child custody, termination of parental rights, and adoptions, which is what everybody wants to do when they become a family court judge. So paternity, it's pretty self-explanatory. You are establishing paternity, you are establishing child support, you are enforcing those orders, you're setting custody and visitation for parents of unmarried children. Dependency, neglect, and abuse docket, that's probably better known as the child abuse docket. And in that case, that is when the county and the Cabinet for Health and Family Services are trying to figure out whether or not a child has been abused, neglected, or is dependent. In that docket, it's essentially determining whether or not a child's been abused or neglected, and if the child can safely remain in their home. If they can't, whether or not that the parents can have visitation safely, and if they can't, what they can do to get that child back. The domestic violence docket is, again, pretty self-explanatory. In that docket, we are determining, you know, whether or not an act of domestic violence has happened, whether or not it's likely to happen again, and issue orders of protection to victims of domestic violence to help and try and keep them safe by keeping their perpetrator away. And then divorce, child custody. Divorce, you know, you are talking about a lot of things. You're talking about child custody. You're talking about visitation. You're talking about the division of property, the division of debts, whether or not you're setting a child support order, whether or not you're getting maintenance, or sometimes better known as alimony. So, I mean, family court really touches on all of the major issues in someone's life. You probably, if you're not involved in family court, you probably know someone who you're related to or you're good friends with who is. I mean, family court judges really have the ability to affect a person's life, which is why it's very important that we elect people who know what they're doing, who are experienced in this role. Because, I mean, you're talking about a person's life and the things that they value most. I mean, what's more important than your kids, right?
Yeah, exactly. Family court judges deal with so many different issues that affect people's daily lives. And, you know, I think family court can often have like negative connotations for people because they've dealt with contentious divorces or custody disputes, or they, like you said, they know somebody who has. And some lawyers even refer to family court as like the Wild West. So do you think that there are any like misnomers or misunderstandings about family court that you'd want to share with people?
You know, that's a really good question. And one of the ones that pops to my mind, the thing that I think I hear most often, especially currently in my role as a child support prosecutor, is that this is happening to me in this manner because I'm a man. This is happening to me in this manner because I'm a woman. If the shoe was on the other foot, there are a lot of people who think that based on their gender that they're getting a different outcome. And I hear it all the time. I hear it from men. I hear it from women. And it's, I just don't think it's true. I think that especially in Jefferson County, our judges are really good about being even-handed. It doesn't matter if you're a man. It doesn't matter if you're a woman. You are going to get the same result. I mean, unfortunately, the reason that these people feel this way is because family court is a slow-moving beast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is backlogged. It is, to get a court date, you are going months out. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. But that's something that popped in my head. It's just that it doesn't really matter if you're a man. It doesn't matter if you're a woman. Family court doesn't really care about that. What it cares about is, you know, getting the right answer. And your answer is going to be the same whether or not you're a man or a woman. But that's just what popped in my head.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something you hear from people about family court. So that's some good insight.
We as the family court attorneys all know that more of the things that happen in family court than not are some of people's worst days, unhappiest days. So I just think that that's an important thing to remember when you hear people's critique of family court, is these are some of people's worst memories, with the exception of adoptions. Yeah. And an occasional, you know, positive custody or divorce experience where people, you know, feel like they've resolved something positively. But while we're speaking a little bit about gender and the differences that people think affect their experience in family court, Darren, you are a first-time candidate and you are running against two women, Lori Goodwin and Judge Ellie Kerstetter. They've both run campaigns before. So why now? Why did you decide to throw your hat in the ring against these two candidates who have run prior campaigns?
So I actually filed before Lori Goodwin did. So when I filed, the only candidate who was currently filed was Ellie Kerstetter. And Ellie wasn't actually really a factor in whether or not I filed. I filed because, you know, when I graduated from law school, and while I was in law school, I actually clerked for a family court judge. And then immediately after law school, my first job was with Judge Dolly Berry, who's now retired, but who was a wonderful judge and who was wonderful to work for. And I mean, like, you really get to see how much of an impact a judge can have on someone's life. You can understand that, you see how important their role is. And so over the course of my career, I've been in family court in many different areas. I've served as a prosecutor in a couple different family court areas. I've worked as a private attorney, as Jasmine said, and I clerked for Judge Berry in family court. And, you know, my experience has just led me to a point where I think that I could do the job, and I think I could do it really well. And I think that that is what we need. I think we need judges who want to serve the community, who want to do a good job, who care about getting the answer right, who care about, you know, this is what the law says. This is what the facts say with the law. And, you know, we just got to elect judges who do that. So when I saw the seat come up, I mean, I just gotten a foster daughter a couple of months ago. It wasn't necessarily my best timing of a decision, but with the pandemic where we're all at home, I thought, you know what? I'm not going anywhere anyway. So this might be a good idea to try to see if I can do this, because honestly, like I said, I think I could be really good at it, but you never know until you try. You never know that if you can get elected until you try.
Yeah, so you mentioned that currently you're a prosecutor in family court, and I think when most people hear prosecutor, they think of someone who is prosecuting crimes, but your job's a little different. So can you talk about your role as a prosecutor in family court?
So absolutely. So I have actually been assigned, like I said, to the two different divisions of family court that have prosecutors. I've been assigned to the dependency, neglect, and abuse docket, and I'm currently assigned to the child support docket. So in my current role as a child support prosecutor in family court, I'm not prosecuting crimes. I am not in criminal court at any time. I don't really want to be. So what I do a lot of the time is helping people establish child support orders, helping people get reductions in their child support orders. I help establish paternity. I help enforce child support orders. An important thing to know about the prosecutors who work for the Division of Child Support, we don't represent the mother, we don't represent the father, we don't represent the guardian, we represent the state. And we represent the state's interest in setting an appropriate child support order to make sure that the child whoever they're with gets the most appropriate support. So a lot of what I do is on a docket, a paternity docket, for example, I will meet with both parties. I'll meet with the custodian and the non-custodial parent and see if I can help them work out an agreement. It's sort of mediation, if you know. I am helping them, you know, talk through the issues. I have the legal knowledge. And sometimes it really helps a person to have someone say, you know, this is what the law says. You know, you're free to have the judge rule for you. But if you go in front of the judge, you know, it's their decision. You don't really have a say after that. But while you're mediating, you can sort of help them, you know, work out what's best for their family. Because a lot of times, in fact, I would say 90% of the time, people work out agreements. And my job is to help them do that. And then on the other side, which is actually where I know you from, Jasmine, we file motions for contempt to try and compel people to pay child support. The purpose of contempt in family court, it's not to punish them, it's to compel them. You know, jail is a possible consequence of, you know, repeated failure to not pay child support. But in family court, if you end up in jail for not paying child support, you are really not paying child support, and you will not pay child support because it is not our goal to put you in jail. It is our goal to get you to pay your child support order so that whoever has the kid is getting the appropriate support then so that they can take care of the child.
Yeah. So, you know, people may not know that there were prosecutors in family court, and likewise, there are also public defenders in family court for that reason, because when you have something that can carry jail time, even if it's not a crime, you're still entitled to a public defender. And, you know, that is how we know each other. We've actually been adversaries before. But I'm still here having you on my podcast. So that shows that prosecutors and defense attorneys can get along.
I think we get great results.
Yeah, it's definitely, even though we disagree about what should happen, or, you know, we may disagree on if jail time should be a punishment, you know, for failure to pay child support, it's definitely less adversarial in family court than it is in criminal court, I would say. All right, switching gears a little bit. So we often ask legislative candidates on the podcast what types of legislation they plan on sponsoring. And while, you know, judges aren't in a position to make law in a legislative sense, I do think judges are in a good position to, you know, make changes and advocate for reform. So what types of changes or reforms would you like to see when it comes to family law in Kentucky, or just with regard to family court operations?
So I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest problems with family court is the backlog, how the system is overwhelmed. And honestly, it results in people who need help having to wait months, if not several months, to get that help. And what I would like to see is, you know, I would advocate for some type of way to make sure that we are addressing the imminent needs of people. And imminent, when you're in family court, when you are a participant in family court, imminent means something different to those of us who are just working it. At the end of the day, when I'm working a case, you know, it's my job. It's not my life. But when it is your life, and when that's involved, and you're told that your hearing to get a child support order isn't going to be until April, I mean, like, that hurts. And yes, I mean, the order is going to be retroactive, but still, you're being forced to take care of your child with only whatever support the non-custodial parent is giving you. So one thing I would like to see is, you know, let's work on this backlog. And honestly, this backlog is only going to be worse because of the pandemic. I mean, like, things are getting pushed way out because of the system just cannot handle it. And I mean, there's some of it you can't do anything about. Like, you can't control the fact that we have limitations on how many cases can really be on a docket, because that's the safe number that we can do. But I mean, there is a solution. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but there's a solution to move these cases along. And it would be my goal, if I was given the privilege of serving, to make sure that, I mean, we were working through this backlog. We were getting people timely hearings on things that you shouldn't have to wait 4 months for a 30-minute hearing. You just shouldn't. Another little thing, I mean, obviously, not really a little thing. As a family court judge, I would really be advocating for, to the extent I could, getting more services for individuals who are on the dependency, neglect, and abuse docket. I mean, these people need help. And I mean, I realize that it is a source of, you know, there's only so much money, but we've got to prioritize families. We've got to prioritize helping people keep their children in their homes. And I mean, like, we're currently dealing with a second pandemic of people who are, you know, abusing drugs, and they need assistance to help them get their lives back together so that they can have their children and that they don't continue having children who are then removed again. The more services that we can provide these people and the earlier we provide them, the better our community is going to be.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the need for resources for families because, you know, as a public defender, I dealt with families who were on truancy dockets or on the dependency, neglect, and abuse docket. And here we just have so few things, and we refer people to our few resources, but sometimes it's just not enough. So I definitely agree with you there.
So speaking of practicing law during the pandemic and how the family courts are doing that and all these same dockets that we keep referring to, I work on what we would call a child abuse docket. And we're holding a lot of those dockets via Zoom, Skype, telephonic hearings, telephonic trials. Darren, can you tell us a little bit more about how other dockets, the rest of family court, are operating during this?
Sure. So a lot of hearings are happening via Zoom. Some of them are, like you said, happening telephonically. It's really judge dependent. So there, I have one judge that I practice in front of regularly who every hearing is held via Zoom, and it works like clockwork. I have another judge who prefers to hold all hearings via telephone. So, you know, you work with the judges. I mean, it is what they believe works best for them. So you follow their lead. The paternity docket is currently happening in person. However, they are limiting the number of cases that are available to be on that. You have the option, I think, to request that you don't appear in person, that you appear telephonically or via Zoom, but most people aren't taking up on that. So the paternity docket, it's happening in person, and it's not being well attended from my experience by people, but I mean, if they have the option of being there, a lot of people just, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's a pandemic or if they have chosen not to appear for some other reason, just, you know, aren't coming to court. I think the domestic violence docket is sort of the same way. I know you have the ability to appear via Zoom if you've worked it out in advance. But I mean, like, there's just some dockets that haven't figured out how to do entirely remotely yet.
Yeah, I think that's been something that's been really difficult for attorneys and for the people who are in court right now, is every judge is doing something differently and people don't know if they need to show up.
I think a lot of the judges are struggling with, you know, they don't want it to be an access issue. They don't want to deny anyone their opportunity to be heard on a level playing field. I know the judge that Darren and I both appear in front of that prefers the telephone, his opinion of that is basically that if one person's going to appear by phone, everyone needs to appear by phone. So then at least he's getting all the testimony in the same format. And I can't necessarily disagree with that mentality. So,
yeah, I don't think there's like a good answer, and all of the ways, like, you know, have various levels of success. But I think it's a difficult question for any judge.
And I think that, I mean, obviously you have to also think about, I mean, there are a lot of people in family court who just don't have the resources to appear via Zoom.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain level of technology to be able to do it. And I've actually come across less and less, fewer and fewer people who don't have at least a smartphone where they can appear via Zoom. But the point is, there are ways to do it. There are ways to safely, you know, hold court, to keep the wheels of justice moving. Because, like I said earlier, these are the most important things going on in these people's lives.
Yeah.
They need answers, and they can't wait a year for the pandemic to end.
Right. And even before the pandemic, like you said, we have huge backlogs in family court. All right. So we don't often have local candidates on the podcast, so this is for our Jefferson County listeners. tell us why you believe that you're the best candidate for family court judge.
So I am asking that all of my Jefferson County listeners vote for me because I believe that I have the experience both professionally and personally to really do a good job to be able to serve the citizens of Jefferson County. I've worked as a prosecutor in the dependency, neglect, and abuse docket. I've worked as a child support prosecutor, worked as an attorney doing divorces and child custody cases. I've worked for a family court judge, learning all the different aspects of family court, and which was a wonderful job. And it's probably the best job I've ever had, honestly. But all of that experience combined with my personal experiences with family court. So I am the child of a pretty messy divorce. And I was an adult when my parents got divorced. And it resonates with me today how much this just ripples through a family's life. I mean, it affects a family in so many ways. And as I've mentioned earlier, I'm a foster parent. I currently, I'm very invested in a small little girl who's currently playing upstairs. And I understand how important these are to families. And I think with my personal experience and my professional experience, I think that I am ready to serve the citizens of Jefferson County, and I would really appreciate your vote.
Darren, how can people get involved with the campaign?
That is a great question, EA. If you are interested in learning more about me or my campaign, we are on social media, on Facebook and Instagram. It's Neil for Judge. Neil is spelled N-E-E-L. It is a little different than the normal spelling. So Neil for Judge. You can also go to my website, neilforjudge.com, and you can read more about me. You can watch some of my campaign videos that we've put out so far. You can request a yard sign. You can sign up to volunteer. Or through any of those ways, you can send me a message if you have any more questions, because I am here to respond to your questions and introduce myself to you.
All right, Darren, thank you for coming on the show and good luck in your race.
Thanks so much, EA and Jasmine.
All right, so next, EA is going to stick around with us today and she is going to give us our COVID update.
Jasmine, it's kind of ironic that I'm back 6 months into the pandemic. The last time I co-hosted with Robert, when you were out 1 week, it was the week that things really slowed down to a stop. We were recording and we didn't know, but the SEC tournament was being canceled while we were recording. So that's where we've been in the last 6 months. So last week, it was a record-breaking weekly total of 4,742 cases in Kentucky and a record high of deaths of 66. And that also means we crossed the threshold of 1,000 deaths. And there's going to be a wreath-laying ceremony, and flags are going to fly at half-staff to remember those 1,000 Kentuckians that we've lost.
You know, we're lucky to not have the death toll that other states have had, but we definitely need to remember these lives. And I saw Beshear's press conference today, and you can tell he's definitely sad.
Yeah, you know, there's plenty of states that have had 1,000 death days, or, it is crazy. To think that it's such a tragic marker that we've hit, but also that we have been, relatively successful even still. So it's hard to swallow all of it 6 months in.
Mm-hmm.
Beshear told us to be cautious because we were going to have some low numbers this week due to lab closures over the holiday weekend. So Tuesday, there were only 273, but there were only about 1,300 tests. Today's number was 667, so that's still a little lower than numbers from the last couple weeks, but it might just be that same lag in lab testing. Our positivity rate is still on the decline, so that is some good news. And honestly, personally, with private schools resuming in person and college kids returning to campus, I'm pleasantly surprised to continue to see some downward trends.
Yeah, and people returning to college campuses may be why testing is up too, because maybe they're doing more testing on campus and things like that. But if we can continue to see a decline in the positivity rate, definitely good news.
So speaking of college, Louisville football will resume this weekend. And they initially said they were going to have 18,000 fans in the stadium. And then the governor stepped in and he said he's approved a plan for a reduced 12,000 fans. UK also released their plan this week, which I'm not sure if it's been totally finalized because I saw something released by the SEC today that said ours is still TBD. But the plan we've asked for is 20%. I said we, but Jasmine and I are both UK.
Yeah, we are.
20% outdoor capacity, 50% in the suites. And I think that 50% suite stat has gotten a little bit of backlash because, you know, everything we know about COVID indicates it's always less safe to be indoors. And so that just immediately jumps out and looks like a way to keep your rich fans happy. But ultimately, we're still talking very small numbers in those suites. And I do think there's an argument that those suites have outdoor seats associated with them as well. So maybe you can even spread out further than in like your packed stadium seating.
Yeah, I understand the frustration, though, because clearly spread is so much worse indoors and they're giving them more capacity. And it's kind of just been a theme of UK athletics the past couple years of doing things that help the rich fans. So I definitely understand that frustration. But I do think the suites only hold like 16 people. I think both sides to that.
But I think the argument was that if you reduced it down to 20%, if you've got some that only seat 20, you could only take 4 people. And what's the point? And so right, I see both sides.
Yeah. And there may be like a family or something that has one that has more people than that anyways. So, yeah.
Relatedly, we've got more Kentucky legislators that have COVID. Attica Scott recorded a video over the weekend saying she tested positive. Her video is actually pretty upbeat. So she doesn't directly say I'm asymptomatic, but her video is basically saying, hey, you never know. Keep going to get tested. Stay safe. Stay home once you're waiting for your results or you have your results or whatever. So, you know, we wish her well, but Gerald Neal was admitted to the hospital with COVID. So obviously we want to send him well wishes and hope he actually recovers quickly. And obviously you hope that Attica doesn't have any symptoms that she didn't know she had when she posted that video. On Tuesday, the governor also announced that Kentucky has received $450,000 in grants for critical repairs and equipment at Kentucky River ports in Owensboro, Henderson, Eddyville, Louisville, and Paducah. So that's just some exciting positive updates from the regular press conferences that the governor's having. At least there's some positive news for us.
Yes, I feel like our COVID updates are getting a little shorter. And I think that's because there haven't been a lot of new regulations or changes in regulations, because it seems like we're kind of just going on our way and continuing our mask mandate. So a little shorter COVID update than usual. All right, so our next story, as usual for the last several months, is the Breonna Taylor investigation and the protests in Louisville. First, we have to start with Derby Day. And as expected, it was a big day for demonstrations. I encourage everyone to read Bailey Loosemore's Courier Journal piece about the Derby and its history of segregation. It talks about a ban on black jockeys in the 1920s, and also about the city of Louisville's ban on Derby weekend cruising in the 2000s. You know, so I definitely encourage people to read that to kind of understand the Derby's history with black residents in Louisville. But despite calls for cancellation, the Derby did go on as planned. Early in the day, the Not Effing Around Coalition came back to Louisville and they assembled downtown, and a white militia counter-protesting group showed up in Louisville as well. Their leader, who's known as the Angry Viking, praised Kyle Rittenhouse, and, you know, that's the 17-year-old who shot multiple protesters in Kenosha. So that tells you a little bit about the Angry Viking and the group that he was leading. When the two groups met downtown, the counter-protesting white militia group, they engaged in yelling and shoving, and they also brought like insect killer and wasp spray. And one of them was caught saying, here, take this, it works better than mace, or something to that effect. But luckily, things eventually did end peacefully. And I guess the confrontation went on for a pretty considerable amount of time without any police presence. And when LMPD arrived, there was really nothing to see, and the armed counter-protesters were on their way out. And LMPD was asked why they weren't there. They said, sometimes when we go into a situation or an area, it may escalate the situation, tensions may rise. So this is kind of frustrating to hear because, you know, it's weird that they showed up with National Guard troops in the West End a couple months ago and have tear gassed peaceful protesters not so long ago. And here they weren't there.
Right. I was going to say, I don't think either of us would disagree that sometimes the police showing up to things escalates potential violence. It's just that it's, you know, hypocritical this at this stage in the game. With so many times where we've had such a police presence and things have gone south.
Right. So. And so we can see that things can work out without heavy police presence. But, you know, it's only when there was a white militia group there that the police didn't show up. So later in the afternoon, protesters gathered near Churchill Downs, and there was no shortage of police presence there as protesters simply sat in the grass. The group Until Freedom was also present, and they held a protest at South Central Park near Churchill Downs. As the derby began, arrest the cops chants were heard as my old Kentucky home played. Then once the derby ended, protesters returned to the park. And you know, I think it's important, you know, also remember whatever you think about the protests is that these gatherings have always been a place for healing and community. People are frustrated. They are angry, but they're also creating these communal spaces and using it as a time for healing as well. And Derby Day was no different as people ate and danced and sang at the end of the night. So that's Derby Day. And now we have a big new announcement this week. It was announced on Monday that Interim Chief Robert Schroeder, who, you know, just took over as the Interim Chief in June, would retire, and Yvette Gentry, a Black woman, will become the Interim Chief of LMPD. Interim Chief Gentry became a Louisville police officer in 1990, but she's since worked for Metro Government. She's worked in the nonprofit sector, and she was once the director of Louisville Metro Youth Detention Services a few years ago as well. Something to note is there's something a little bit strange about the timing of Schroeder's announcement. He's been subpoenaed to testify before Metro Council in their investigation of Mayor Fisher's handling of the Breonna Taylor investigation, so the investigation of the investigation. And it's unclear whether he can be subpoenaed as a former Metro official. The mayor's office didn't really like getting questions about this, but it's just something a little weird about the timing of it all.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting, I think, to see what comes from that and whether we know if the what the intentions behind this change of interim leadership, you know, what it really means. But I do think it sounds like generally people who are far more in the know about this system than I am to like this replacement and think pretty fondly of Yvette Gentry.
Yeah, and I've heard the same sentiments from people as well. So we also have a bit of an update about the subpoenas that I was just referring to. So with regard to the subpoenas, Schroeder and Chief of Public Safety Amy Hess, they've tried to fight the subpoenas because of pending civil lawsuits. And Judge Audra Eckerly, who is a judge in Jefferson Circuit Court, ruled that the government officials could be subpoenaed, so the subpoenas have now been reissued. In her order, Judge Eckerly found that they did not show irreparable harm by being subpoenaed, and that's, you know, that's the standard that they have to show, and stated that, in reality, every activity carries with it the potential of litigation. Were that risk alone sufficient reason to act clandestinely, no government operation would be open or subject to review, and the Open Meetings Act would be pointless. So now Robert Schroeder and Amy Hess, I think that they will be subpoenaed for next week's meeting. So we'll see if any testimony is taken next week. Also, there was a big report today from Wave 3 that the Breonna Taylor case is being presented to a grand jury in an undisclosed location this week, and that an announcement is expected next week. Very quickly, a couple hours later, there was a statement from Daniel Cameron's office that expressed frustration at conflicting rumors and reports and unnamed sources, and said that the investigation remains ongoing until we make an announcement. So they seem to slam down that rumor, but I don't think that means that there's not a grand jury right now.
True. Jasmine, I don't know how you feel about this, but as somebody who works downtown, I mean, as we talked about earlier, I'm coming into the courthouse at least a few days a week, 3 to 4 days a week, mm-hmm. depending on the schedule. And As somebody who works downtown, I'm just exhausted by the rumor mill. And this is pretty constant, has been since June on. But this is probably the most legitimate news source that's trying to put forth that story that Cameron's office has to respond to.
I think this is definitely like the first time we've heard it from a local news source. And, you know, so I have no idea. I would hope that if they're going to report that, that they have a good source. But we really have no information about what's going on. In their report, they said that there was expected to be 2 days of grand jury testimony. And I think it's worth noting for people, I've said this before on the podcast, but grand jury testimony is usually about 2 to 5 minutes. So that would be a lot of testimony afforded for the officers whose cases might be going before a grand jury.
And just one more thing about on Breonna Taylor's case, The Daily, the New York Times podcast, they're doing 2 episodes on her case. It started today. The first episode was excellent. So the second episode will be tomorrow. They came to town and they talked to lots of family members, her mother, her boyfriend. It's really well done.
I'll definitely have to listen to that. And our very last piece of news, and this was breaking shortly before we recorded the podcast, we found out that Daniel Cameron is on Trump's Supreme Court of the United States shortlist.
This is just, this news is so very 2020. I mean, the fact that, Jasmine's exact age, but our proximate contemporary has somehow made his way onto the president's list of potential appointees if he were to get it reelected in November. It's just boggles the mind. And I know a lot of our colleagues, a lot of our lawyer friends have reach out to each other to say things such as, I litigated more cases today than Daniel Cameron has in his career. So it's just the strangest of times. It just continues to be.
Yeah, I'm a little bit younger than Daniel Cameron, but I do have more courtroom and more appellate experience than
certainly
he does.
Do.
And, you know, no one's calling me up to SCOTUS. And I know you have that experience too. So, you know, we're just lowly circuit court workers.
It's public servants over here.
Yeah, so, you know, more 2020 news. That is all that we have for you today. I want to thank EA and Darren for coming on the show. So yeah, thanks for being here. And that sort of concludes my 3-week legal series on the podcast.
Thanks, Jasmine. It was fun.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. You can like our Facebook page. We have a newsletter that comes out on Friday mornings that will resume next week. You can subscribe to it and forward Kentucky's newsletters at forwardky.com/email. And we have a Patreon page where you can support what we're doing for as little as $1 a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And we're part of the Dimcast Network. One last note for this week is that you may have heard different music at the beginning of our show. Robert and I have talked about changing our song for a long time. We have a free Creative Commons version of My Old Kentucky Home that we basically used it because it was one of only 2 free Kentucky-related songs on Creative Commons that we could legally use. But we've decided it is time to retire it, and it's long overdue. So we will be looking for a new theme song for our podcast. And so we've got a placeholder song for now, but I did just want to mention that we will be retiring My Old Kentucky Home, and should have done so long ago. But that's the show, and thank you for listening.